My name's Bernadette Russell. Welcome to episode 9 of How to Be Hopeful, a podcast all about hope, how to find it and how to keep hold of it once you've found it. This week I'm really delighted to be chatting with Peter Cully. He's the creative leader and founder of the Spatial Affairs Bureau. I love the sound of that. I think it sounds like a sort of a kind of 1940s detective agency. But it's actually an architecture, landscape and general design studio, which is based in the UK and in the US. I was really excited about speaking to an architect. I'm really interested in how cities are going to change and how they can change our lives for the better and to be more positive. I wanted to talk to him about hope with regard to the future of cities, especially as more and more and more of us are going to be living in urban environments and less of us, perhaps, in rural environments. According to Peter's website, the ethos for Spatial Affairs Bureau's practice is being open across disciplines and scales, recognising and embracing the limits of the scenario and bringing experts in their fields to enable rich collaborations and experimentations. I'm really interested and was really interested and can't wait to find out what he's got to say, especially as I know he works closely with artists. And architecture feels like a really wonderful combination of art and commerce. So without further ado, here's our conversation. I hope you enjoy it. So, hello. First of all,
Hello, Bernadette.
Could you introduce yourself, Peter? Let me know where you are and how you are today, actually.
How I am. Okay. Well, I'm Peter Cully. I'm an architect, amongst, I guess, other things. And I'm in Suffolk, and it's called the Shotley Peninsula. So it's quite interesting. It's a bit of land that sort of goes to a point and ends in nothing, but between two rivers, the Orwell and the Stour. So it's slightly like land that, a bit not on the way to anywhere, which I like. Oh. And I'm well, because I've just been on this lovely walk. So I feel good today.
A beautiful time, because it's about 7 o'clock, isn't it? It's this lovely, lovely
time. And it's incredible spring. I mean, it's sort of that very slowly unfolding spring, but at the same time, it's quite shocking from one day to the next. You know how different it is.
Yeah, it's astonishing, isn't it? That some of the trees, it feels as though only yesterday they were just bare branches.
I know, exactly. So it's sort of interesting time of year that way. Nature can be quite radical, can't it? Quite a shock.
It can be. And I feel that we're quite lucky, even though there's awful stuff going on, which we'll come to shortly. It's a good time of year because at least the spring's kind of providing a little bit of hope and beauty. Whereas if this had all been happening in the thick of January, I think it would have been harder. Do you?
Yeah. I mean, even I was thinking, standing outside for the shops, on a 2 meter distance. Imagine if that has been, horrific winter weather.
That's true.
I mean, that would have been really rough. But, as far as this time of year, hope's a funny thing, isn't it? Because it's double-edged, isn't it? If you're in a crisis and there are signs of life and optimism, it sort of reassures, but it's also can be quite hard, I think. I mean, but better to have it.
I think so. I mean, there's definitely kind of pain sometimes in the mix, I think, or sort of melancholy. But we'll come on to that. I love the way we're going straight in the deep end. But could you first of all introduce your company and your work, Peter, just so people know?
Yep. So I'm an architect, as I mentioned. I have a practice which is called Spatial Affairs Bureau. And it's named that way because I feel like as long as it's a sort of spatial dialogue or investigation, then I'm fine to get involved, which could also be writing. But my driver is, I guess, spatial situations. And then the affairs is there because I think stories are very important and narrative and tales. And I think that's, I think a lot about sort of humans and animals and how we're also an animal, but I think that does set us apart, humans, because of this thing of telling stories and being interested in recounting things or understanding that something's part of something else. So I think that also apply, that can or should apply probably to architectural dialogues. So that's why it's called
fantastic.
That anyway.
I love it because to me it slightly sounds like a sort of private detective agency.
It's
got a little bit of noir about it, which I really enjoy.
Well, it's a bit tongue-in-cheek as well, and I think we always need to find a bit of humour.
Absolutely. No, it's quite playful, which I really enjoy.
Oh,
and it's
thanks.
Great that you like stories. We'll talk more about stories later. Can I just ask you, first of all, I don't know whether this is impossible to answer or to recall, but why did little Peter choose architecture?
Oh, little Peter. Well, it was a long time ago. I think I probably first got into it, and other architects say this, just by sort of drawing... I don't know if you call it buildings, but drawing enclosures, drawing plans. And I always used to sort of wrestle with changing the environment. So I was always thinking about, well, what if you added a staircase through here or took this bit out and opened that up? You know, it was like an interrogation. And a lot of architects say that they were drawing plans, you know, something... a sort of translation of space they're drawing quite early on. And I didn't know what an architect was. That wasn't something that was exactly, you know, sort of in my family or culture. But because I was doing that, you know, some people had said to me, I guess, someone or other had said, you know, or maybe some people had said, well, you might want to investigate what architecture or being an architect is. And so then I, you know, very diligently did that as I got a bit older. You know, there's professional body is called the ROBA, the Royal Institute of British Architects. I don't think they have it now, but then they had these quite nice books of, you know, what does it mean to be an architect for younger people.
That's great.
And I think I wrote off and got those, and I thought, oh, this sounds really interesting. And then when I was I was on a track to do that. I could say from when I was 9 or 10, I felt like, yeah, that's what I want to do.
Wow, you're so that's a blessing, isn't it?
Have I think so. Yeah, I mean, it turns out it's a reasonably, what would you call it? It's quite a complex life to navigate, I think. But yes, it's a mission and it's a clarity and a belief, yes. And so that was sort of, yeah, purpose. But I remember when I was, whatever the age is, when you go to choose what A-level subject you want to do, you know, I guess that's about, O-level subject, sorry. So I guess that's about 13 or 14 when you start to choose that maybe. I remember my school just wasn't sort of, they didn't respond really. They just was, it was quite blank. So then I had to do more research, oh, which would be the best things. And I said, well, I'm doing that because, so it was slightly like foraging a path. And then I remember when I was about 16, and this probably is useful for what we're going to come on to, in my art class, I started doing these sort of scenes. I don't know what prompted me to do it, but these scenes around the town that we grew up in, or we grew up around, Colchester. And I would sort of take these photographs, and I've sort of forgotten this actually, but I would take photographs of certain bits of the street, and I would sort of imagine what it could be like. I mean, actually, basically, if you added a lot of trees, it wasn't quite as basic as that.
Wow.
But I was doing things where I just felt like there was a sort of latent beauty that had all got lost in roundabouts and car parking and lampposts. And I don't know where that came from, but I was doing that in my art class, sort of these collages of eroding sort of foreground. And, because they were quite historic buildings and there were, I think, quite nice trees and quite older trees. But overall, it just looked like a very sort of barren environment. But I still do that now. I mean, as I move through most situations, I'm imagining if you pulled certain things off and added other things, what you would get. And that is interesting because that's sort of like what I do in my work now. I never have an idea that I want to knock everything down and start again. It's very much finding what's already in the scenario. And maybe editing, and quite often I feel like it's to do with vegetation and trees, bringing that into the right balance.
Well, that's another thing we have in common then, trees. And it's very interesting, actually. A lot of, I don't know about Colchester, but I'll find out actually, but a lot of British towns and cities which are being reforested now, effectively, all their trees got taken down because they're expensive to maintain. So what's useful though about places like Colchester is still the tree pits are often still there.
Oh, interesting.
So you can just plant straight back into them. Yeah, it's worth
looking.
Yeah.
That's so bizarre. So they were taken out because they just couldn't water them or feed them, basically.
Well, it's varied. Sometimes it's the maintenance, because it's not only that, but they have to be, they might have to be trimmed or pollarded.
Yeah, I see.
So sometimes it's expensive. I don't think it's ever done with malice, but certainly in London, and particularly in southeast London, there's just loads of tree pits. So we've just been, because I work for Trees for Cities, volunteer for Trees for Cities, and we've just been plopping trees back in where the tree pits are, I haven't been.
That's amazing.
Yeah,
I love that. It's a bit like putting the railways back down in the tracks that are left behind, isn't it? I think that's a really interesting line. I mean, you mentioned my company sounds a bit like detective agency. I think a lot of this is forensic. You do go and you look for clues of what might have been there. And I don't think it's about trying to go back and put everything like it was, but it's being opportunistic for what, whether it's infrastructure or poetry, whatever. They go together probably, but what might be there to work with. And I like what you're saying, because there's a lot of, I use that word a lot, I suppose, latent circumstance ready to be found again or found for the first time. So the other thing I think about trees is, and this is a thing that particularly happened to British, well, probably all across the UK, was the effect of the car and transport engineers being given really the sort of pole position in terms of planning. And their priority was to move cars at a constant and reasonably high speed. And I think trees were a real issue with that.
Yeah.
Because trees were seen, like if you're coming up to a roundabout, I was thinking, well, why isn't a roundabout just full with trees? But there's some idea that could be dangerous. But of course, it's always a counterintuitive solution. And the more you make things visible, the faster people drive. So you don't need to see what's going on the other side of a roundabout. But I think there was a real sense that trees were dangerous, and they got in the way of views. And in fact, I think now we recognize, obstacles in a sense are good at making everybody look more carefully and go slower. So we're in a lucky time, I think, because so much has changed.
Yeah, I'd like to come on to talk a little bit about sort of nature and urban environments coexisting, and how your sort of take on that. But just because you spoke to something in the interview you did with Josh Cooperman, which really interested me, which was regarding work and workspaces, Peter, if we could just talk about that for a moment. The reason that was really interesting is lots and lots of people over the last couple of weeks have contacted me in various ways and said, for the first time, I don't have to do my 2-4-hour commute, 3-hour commute. No. I work in the cloud, so there's no need to do it. I don't want to go back to normal work. There's no need for me to be in the office every day, and I really hope that that doesn't have to happen. And I wondered whether, in terms of the future of sort of work and workspaces, which I think is something you're interested in as well, there's a lot of people who during the current lockdown are finding that they're enjoying not the commute, etc. And I just wondered if you thought that the global pandemic might accelerate the move to working from home some or all of the time, as employees and companies hopefully see the benefits of that. And if that might accelerate, how much that might change your practice in terms of designing workspaces or work environments, or has it already affected it, sort of changing?
Yeah, well, I mean, I remember when I was at college a long time ago, in 1992, we did a project. We were set a project for coming up with, it was called a telehamlet. There was that quaint term, I think it was teleworking, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Back then. And so we well, not all of us, but you could choose which projects you did. I chose to do this one that was called a telehamlet. And I remember I had this scheme where it was these sort of pods all laid out in a beautiful area outside of Liverpool in Cheshire, I think. And it was the idea that you would have a sort of loose community, but you had space to work that was on your own. And, you know, it was definitely viable then, but that was a kind of not about radical, but it was definitely not a typical project I think you would do as a student. But of course, students do projects that are often a bit more out of the box than often happens in practice. But anyway, that's what now then 30 what's that 30
it's a while ago
31 years ago maybe is that 89 90 yeah is that right
92, anyway 2002
is it? Yeah 20 so anyway it's decades ago. So and also incidentally 2 years before that we had all done a course that was about the impending environmental catastrophe. And so, yes.
Good.
And we were learning all about how to build in responsible ways and also about trees could be the answer. So I'm responding to what you just said about and has it already, because I think what happens, maybe it takes some kind of massive, I know about a crisis, but upheaval or... it takes something quite major, I think, for things to really go into popular culture. And by popular culture, I just mean culture that is, you know, commonplace. And so I suspect that the, you know, the kind of imprint for this has gone on a long time. But it may be now that it will gel. I think it probably will gel more. I mean, as far as me working, I've done projects that have gone on for periods of years where I was working in different places from other people in my team, and that was in a completely different, both of those places were different than where the project was going on. And although we would do visits on reasonably regular intervals, I mean, it was done in this way. And actually, I quite like sometimes the discipline of it, because you set the time that you would have the meeting, and there was a kind of emphasis on all being there and ready.
Mm-hmm.
To do that regularly. And I think as people are finding now, there are good and bad sides of it. I mean, one thing is, I think if you'd never met the person physically in their presence, that might be different because, you know, how do you read the nuances? I'm not sure, but I have a sense that maybe if you've met somebody once or several times in person and you've got to know how you do all these nuances of interaction, then I don't know, maybe there's something that we don't all know yet, but I feel like it's not bad working as we are now. I mean, you get so much from eye contact as well, don't you?
Yeah, and body language, all of that stuff is hugely exciting. I suppose I was thinking that there might be hope that there, instead of being a way or another way, that actually there's a variety of ways.
Yes, yeah.
That seems to be sensible, and that instead of the conversations being shut down, they continue. Like, this might work better for this project or this company.
Well, I think that's really pertinent, because I think what I said on that podcast you were referring to is that what has happened, I guess it's really quite recently, is we now don't totally have the sense that working means to sit at a desk of a certain size. And being away from, I mean, of course, not all types of work are at a desk, but let's say desk-based work, and that being away from that desk would mean you're not working. Because, of course, with smartphones, so much of the time it'd be like you're sitting on a train, or you're getting off a train, or you're waking up, or you haven't even got out of bed, or you might be at a formal desk. And I think what you said is the key, that as I mentioned before, I think a lot about how animals operate.
Mm-hmm.
And animals, I think, of course, they have lots of patterns, but they operate all through the day in different environments and doing different things. There's an agility, let's say, to environmental response. So I think it won't be, we all do this now at home. It just means that we can probably be more flexible, and we've probably broken the barrier of video conference as a result of this. I mean, I felt everybody was talking about Zoom or whatnot, and I was thinking, well, I really have done a lot of that before, and I know that I do quite like it in ways, but it's in combination with then meeting people, and I'm very lucky because a lot of my work when it's being built is very physical. That isn't desk related. It's about being on a construction site. So there's a lot of time that's in person. But yeah, I think as we move forward, technical innovation means that we can probably be more and more agile. I think that's a really nice, like you said, what if this happened in winter? I also think, what if this happened 20 years ago, or what would have happened when there was no telephone even? When there was no way of communicating.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess the Spanish flu pandemic, the various plagues, we have had these things before, but not in these circumstances. I think one of the things that you mentioned about Zoom, Peter, that I've certainly noticed in my industry, which is very hands-on, literally everybody's together in the same room, a sort of positive is that we've been forced to learn to use and make the most of creatively Zoom and other kind of technologies. And in a way, that's quite good, because now everyone's like, I didn't really want to do it, but now I can do it. So that is an option. So it's interesting. Yep. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about art, by the way, because I know that as well as being influenced by nature, which we will come back to, you've said that you're influenced by artists and the creative industries. Is that because you've sort of collaborated with artists, or more that because you're an artist yourself?
Well, I never call myself an artist. I mean, I guess one shouldn't necessarily have to call yourself anything. But I've consciously slightly avoided that term, because I think artists, I mean, maybe a certain type of art, maybe I'm talking about visual artists particularly. I think they often occupy a world which is quite... It's very focused, but I think there's an uncompromising nature to how a lot of artists work, which isn't conscious. It's not like a sort of decision. It just sort of, a lot of things are edited out or rejected because they just simply don't resonate. And that's different to an architect, I think, has to take on. You can't really be totally, you're uncompromising in certain ways, definitely, but the practice is so sort of all-encompassing that I think we aren't quite like that. But
and would it be true to say that architecture is collaborative to an extent, in a way that perhaps an artist working on their own is pursuing their own vision? Is your practice more collaborative, or at least there's more need to make compromise because you're going to have clients? And
I mean, I think you have sites, you have budgets, you have clients, you have gravity. Of course, certain artists have gravity, but you have all sorts of, you have acoustics, you have building regulations. You have weather, you have rain. I mean, if you list it out in a certain way, it's quite dull. You know, we have condensation, although I get quite interested in that. But there's many, many factors, which I think is often quite difficult to reconcile, because if you are going to also do the uncompromising, let's say on a sort of spatial or architectonic level, if you're going to do that more creative thing uncompromising, it's quite hard because of all the other factors. So we all have an element maybe of that uncompromising side, because we don't like it if it doesn't go our way. Honestly, I think architects have to also be control freaks in a way, but it's a very, very broad discipline. I have worked on projects where there were, I know because we did the directory, there were 52 consultants. Mm-hmm. And so I think that means you definitely are accustomed to sitting in a group and understanding, you know, lots of other people's priorities, engineers or clients or acousticians or very particularly, you know, user groups, not always just clients. It's often a group of people or an organization that something's being produced for. But just quickly on the artist thing, I think that because they often are able to operate in a slightly more, I feel slightly uncomfortable saying it, but let's say in a cliched way, a lot of artists can be more detached. Yeah. And I've just been watching an Agnes Martin documentary, and she was saying you know, our greatest thing in life, she never has to be with anyone. So let's say if we took her, she just wants to be, she paints extraordinary paintings. She doesn't interact with anyone else. So that's definitely not my world. But anyway, in that sort of uncompromising scenario, which is very self-focused, I think it means that certain trajectories can unfold in their work, because it's not, it's a bit like being in an ivory tower in Oxford or something like that. We all sort of say, is that good as a student, you know, to be locked away in a wonderful tower? There are benefits to that. And of course, there are traps as well. But I think you can learn from artists who just take one theme and that becomes their life and they work through it. And I feel very privileged to have been around that. And I suppose the question, why have I suppose I'm drawn to it. That must be partly why. And I use the word, which is probably cliched, but, you know, poetry or poetics in architecture. And quite often that doesn't exist, I think, or doesn't exist enough in architecture. And so I suppose because I like poetry in life, then that draws you into certain worlds, doesn't it?
And do you, when you think about the poetry in architecture, what does that mean to you? Is that, what's the connection for you between poetry and architecture?
Well, I suppose it's a poetry, it's a looser term. It doesn't really mean, I suppose, confined to, you know, sort of written, the classic poetry. But I think it means beauty and subtlety and delicacy and surprise and the opportunity for, you know, just light to touch you or...
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Also, I think it means cutting through things. I think there can be a poetry when you see scenarios where people who maybe didn't have access to, let's say, those situations or to experience, you know, just light or the beauty of a space. There's a poetry in that that I think architecture can... it can be very relevant immediately to broad groups of people, which is different to art sometimes, because art can sometimes be very sequestered and require investigation. But certain architectures, I mean, architecture is all around you.
Yeah.
And certain architectures...
You can't help but be in it, can you?
No. Sometimes, unfortunately. But done the right way, of course, then you have the ability to affect... a lot more than, you know, just a small number of people's experience of space. So I would say there's a poetry there too about a societal effect. And when I, going back to that thing of when I first wanted to be an architect, I did very much have a sense that in the sort of psychology of architecture, there must be an effect on human well-being in good spaces rather than bad ones. That was definitely a driver for me. Quite early on, I thought that would help. And I don't think it's everything. I don't think architecture can solve everything. I think some architects maybe are too in that direction, but I'm sure it can make a difference.
It can contribute to that, to positive change, yeah.
So another thing I didn't say, but is peace as well, and quiet, you know, being and calm. I think you can find that through architecture. Because we create environments, you know, we create... a filter, in a way, that's what I could describe architecture as. It's a filter, and you could make a bad filter or a good filter, couldn't you? And I think if you get the filter right, then just like trees, again, are a filter for sunlight, aren't they? And they create environments and softness. I think that's the sort of poetry that I mean.
Yeah, I like the idea of sort of buildings holding people as well.
Yes,
and that's a nice way to say it. That can be sort of quite... tender and sheltering. It can also be awe-inspiring. I love buildings and architecture, but of the projects that you've done so far, Peter, if it's not like asking you to choose a favorite child, I wondered if you have one that sort of that you would like to share the story or the making of that really kind of stands out for you, something that you really enjoyed, that you took great pleasure in or pride in.
Well, I have to say, thus far, I should preface and say, I think every project I've done, I've found inspiring, which is very lucky. That's not typical. It comes, you know, with a certain price because they're often, I think those projects are quite tough. But every project, I think I can look at, even this much smaller ones and sort of small residential, there's a delight. But one that maybe is relevant to this call, which I think is interesting, was I spent, and we did mention this, I spent probably 10 years in the off and on around an initiative in Memphis, Tennessee. So that's the sort of, well, Midwest, just the start of the Midwest between what you'd call the East and the Midwest in the U.S. And it's a bit interesting, isn't it? Because Memphis, I think people in Britain, probably in a lot of the world, have there's a resonance when you hear that name, Memphis, but probably not really a sense of what it looks like.
No.
And I think that's quite interesting because, in fact, when I first went there, it has a hugely wide river, the Mississippi. It's a mile wide, up to 3 miles wide when it's in flood. So an enormous sort of natural landscape feature and massive trees because the land is so fertile, like almost unnerving, the scale of the trees.
Yeah.
And then very modest city that is not particularly notable visually, let's say, or architecturally or urbanistically. And but this sort of huge weight of cultural history in terms of music and civil rights, I think and of course the music came from the same issues that the civil rights dialogue did. But that was interesting to me because all sorts of just completely aside from the project, going to a city that was sort of creaking with history but didn't have architectural hallmarks to track it.
Uh-huh.
That like taught me a lot about architecture isn't everything, because I think if you grow up in you know, the old world, which we know, you know, an assassination happens on a grand staircase or you know, somebody not always but quite often somebody sort of with an important cultural position can be tracked back to some sort of, you know, notable family or whatever.
As my German friend said, we are surrounded by Baroque stairwells.
Right, exactly.
So it's like everywhere's got a statue or a plaque.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in Memphis, you know, Martin Luther King was assassinated on something incredibly humble, a motel on an ordinary balcony. And it just tracked through that. I think on the very first day I went there, I saw where Aretha Franklin had been born. You know, it was practically not a house. And you see where Elvis Presley had grown up. All these sort of giants and these giant stories had come from very, very humble architectural backdrops. Mm-hmm. And that was almost like... you know, that was radical for me because, yeah, in what I feel like, yeah, again, in the old world, we everything sort of has a architectural setting. And
how did that feel, Peter? Was that?
I think it was a relief.
Was it? Because I was thinking, yeah. For example, well, all of those people you mentioned, it's kind of outrageous to me that there's not some material marking of that.
Well, no, I suppose I don't mean, strangely for Elvis, it's Graceland, which mm-hmm. of course we think of as ostentatious, but in fact it's not that big. It's not like anything like we might think of the sort of classic McMansion now, but I'm not really meaning so much the marking of it. I'm sort of talking about the origins of it or where it would happen. So in fact, that motel where the Martin Luther King assassination happened is incredibly poignant because they bought the motel and they bought the house that the shot was fired from, and you can see the trajectory of the shot. It's marked out on the ground, and I find that extraordinary. I mean, I quite like, honestly, to stand in that. This sounds quite weird maybe, but to stand under that trajectory, because it's like the eye of the storm in a way. You sort of feel like there's a calm because it is recognized, and that was such an extraordinary thing that happened. But I'm just saying all of the architectural sort of setting for it when it occurred was very modest, nothing dramatic. Whereas Yeah, I think I'd sort of felt like cities were more orchestrated in a way, like a theatre set behind momentous occasions. And Memphis is not like that. And I thought that was really important for me to learn that again, architecture isn't everything. It doesn't necessarily always be there in the background waiting to, sort of support something important.
What was your project there?
So the project was and is, because it's such a big thing that it keeps going. But it was these two guys, and this is a nice story, I think, two guys who felt like they want to make an art center because they think art is really good for the community and there's a lot to be done in that community. Plus, they come from an art background, an art history background, and they really love Memphis. It was sort of that, in a way, that simple. So then, you know, this is sort of folklore now, but, you know, sort of driving around, come across this enormous old Sears distribution center that was a ruin, you know, like the classic sort of Detroit ruin porn, they call it now, don't they?
Yeah.
And 1.5 million square feet, which is a vast building. And they said, oh, well, maybe we could just get that building and do our art center in there, you know. And then 10 years later, or whatever it is, 11 years later, sure enough, there is an art center.
Amazing.
There is a high school. There are 250 homes. There is a cancer outpatient center.
Wow.
There are restaurants. Anyway, it was like one of those stories that shouldn't happen, but did. And
how did they make that happen?
Well, what they did was they found the person who had bought the building. It was still in a totally ruined state, like magical ruined state, with sort of rivers inside and
wow,
all this. And so wonderful reflections inside because of the water. But they found the person who had bought it, who originally had this idea of turning it into a massive, you know, sort of education academy, then had been hit by the 2000, what would it have been? 2008, I guess, had put the end to that plan. So they sort of partnered with the guy that bought the building. He provided them with some seed funding to put a sort of year, each year he gave them a little bit of money to keep developing their plan. And then the way that it worked financially is they partnered, because it was so massive, there's no reason why an art center could fill that all up. It wouldn't be, there's no way it could have filled it up.
Yeah.
So they partnered with lots of other organizations in Memphis, and they all sort of like moved in the end inside this building. So it made a kind of community inside this building. And it's interesting. I think one thing I was going to say is those projects are very interesting because I think you have to recognize cities move at their own pace. And we probably shouldn't judge it by the speed of, you know, our career, you know what I mean? And so that was 10 years, and I feel like that was actually quite fast, the change in 10 years quite fast. But also, I think it's something that probably has to be judged over maybe 30 or 40 years about how it can do what it needs to for the community around it, because in depressed part of a depressed city, I mean, it's changed probably a bit, but it's interesting because there was going to be a road built massive, the I-40, the east-west, you know, one of the two east-west routes across America was going to go right through that part of Memphis, but it was stopped because they're back to forest. There is a virgin forest that it would have gone through, and the citizens of Memphis fought over decades to stop the federal government. And interestingly, the federal government approved it the day after Martin Luther King was assassinated because they thought it would be buried, you know, in all the Armageddon.
Very cynical, that kind of.
Yeah, but in fact, the citizens said no, and they blocked it. But as a result, it's this sort of funny area that sort of left. They'd already started cutting down trees and cutting down houses, so the road never came. But it had sort of been snipped off, you know, either end.
Mm-hmm.
So projects like that are really fascinating, because you're dealing with much more than the even though it's a big building, you're dealing much more with the constraints of the building. You're trying to work out effects, you know, ripple effects. And then I take this position, we can't knock everything down. And we can't say, oh, if only that hadn't happened. We have to say it did happen and there must be opportunity there, which I think we did find.
Because I think just listening to you as well, I was thinking about how the something as transformative of that as that, you know, an old Sears distribution centre, which becomes this beautiful thing. Do you think that that itself, that that's where architecture has the power to sort of give pride of place to a place that perhaps might not have had, because it felt a bit neglected or because people felt that it wasn't cared for, and that that can also kind of bring hope to a community? Because it's certainly in London, some bits of London, things like that have happened and it's sort of made people feel worse, and in other places it's made people feel better. So I think, I don't know what you think about how...
Well, I think, first of all, we don't know all the answers. What you just said is right. And my own sense is what was in America called urban renewal, which is lots of people deciding now they had got the answer and it was best to take certain things down and put in all those roads that we now think shouldn't have been put in. And you see that same approach in, you know, very clearly in a city like Birmingham. They were, it was idealistic. It wasn't people being nasty and thought they're going to make it awful. It was coming up with new ideas and thinking we could live differently, which, of course, is really important to be on top of, like you're asking questions about that now in terms of working. I just have this sense that we can never do it all differently and get it right. But what we have to do is look really carefully, almost forensically, and watch out. Well, certain things, yeah, they need to change. They're not operational. They're not effective. But are there ways you can adjust rather than replace? And the reason I think that that's so important, and a good example in that Memphis one, is that everybody knew somebody who'd had something to do with that building because it employed so many people. So it exists, even though it had been ruined for, I think, maybe 2 decades or 15 years, something like that, and definitely had been unused for 20 or more, it exists still. The building is massive, and buildings at a certain scale and of a certain age have a life. It's a bit like a tree. You know, they don't say much, but they're alive, and so people are invested in it, or there is something quite interesting. It's almost, it sounds a bit naff maybe, but I think there's a sort of soul that can exist. So then it's a very sort of delicate exercise, I think, because how do you know whether you've got it right? Even one thing, do it, but then, and feel like you've got it right, but I think you won't know exactly if everything is right. So again, it's about the ability to listen and watch, isn't it? And if you've got something that can adjust and can, you know, but maybe can respond, but at the same time has got this incredible sort of power of its own because it's been there longer than everybody else, then I think you're really onto something. And it's very, very hard, I think, to manage when you change a city or a part of a city completely. Like if you take all the trees out and you take all the buildings out and you start all over again, it takes, I would say it probably takes about 100 years before that really gets its own soul back, because the trees are going to, you know what I mean? It can work. I know there are examples where you can start again on a large scale, but I think the poetry thing is tricky to get back fast. So I think you can make radical changes, but if you start with the clean slate, it's hard to feel the poetry and also to have the connection, you know what I mean? Like a sort of resonance with somewhere. So that had a lot already going for it in that regard. But I was very keen that you would not actually take any parts of the building down, almost say it is a kind of animal lying there. We can make big changes to it, but we shouldn't be too like, oh, let's take that bit down because that's convenient. I felt, oh, let's work harder and be able to see the whole story and how it's adjusted.
And is this an ongoing project for you?
Well, it's not so much for me now. I mean, we were involved right at the beginning, then we were particularly involved again with the cultural piece, the art centre and the sort of theatre that was done for it. And there's not anything being built now, but I think for me that went on so long that I am involved. You know, I will go back and I want to look how it has evolved and, you know, how maybe, I don't know. I think it's in me. So, but I just truly hope that it's a, I suppose this is the best way, I truly hope it's a project that will need more work in the future and that should be watched, as I said. And, you know, it's sort of like critical observation is necessary, I think, because we won't have got it all right. I'm sure we can't have got everything. There's so many issues.
Well, it's really nice to recognise that also, and to be humble in that, and to give yourself permission. It's kind of giving yourself permission. It can't be all right, and that sort of invites you to, or asks you to keep, to not see something as finished, which I think is quite beautiful as well. To kind of stay with it.
Well, thank you. I agree totally. It's that time thing.
In the podcast again, I think you mentioned a forest overlay.
Yeah, well, when we first started with that project, there was a lot of, let's say, kind of pressure or ambition from the planning department to think of Memphis as another city, you know, sort of think, well, what would be great, because there were a lot of very empty patches of it, lots of empty parking lots, and in fact, lots of places where buildings would have existed that were pulled down. In America, they tend to take empty buildings down. And the only reason that massive building hadn't been taken down is the expense. Mm-hmm. It would have come down if it had been not several million pounds to take it down. So it was sort of like characterized in certain areas by gaps, you know, wastelandy looking. So then the planning department had these things like they call it the urban overlay. And so it was like, well, what we want you to do is build new buildings right up to the street and minimum three stories high. So it's like what you might see as a, you know, fairly traditional set of guidelines. And I said, well, except there's no economy to bring that along. Mm-hmm. So we'll just sit with how it is in that case. And so we came up with an alternative, which we called, instead of building overlay, we called it a forest overlay. And we said, if the idea is to sort of get an intensity and a definition back, then in fact this city is extraordinary because the trees have this incredible scale, because I mean they're enormous because it's so fertile, I guess, and very humid, and so I suppose certain trees really are like they were giants. And I said it would be so great if we just set up a new layer of forest. And maybe some of it is nurseries to grow trees to be able to use, you know, use in certain places. And so, but what's really nice, you can be very sort of formal about it. Like, I don't mean formal arrangement, but you could create form and structure in a way that we think we have to use buildings to. I just felt like I don't think they're coming. And also we wanted to acknowledge this, this moment that the city had overthrown the federal government in the Supreme Court, which was quite shocking. You know, they could have done that. And it required decades, as I said, of fighting. And then, of course, that gets forgotten also very quickly in a city. And so we thought there would be a very nice way of overlaying the trees, but leaving a kind of clearing. The nice thing about forest is clearings, you know, mm-hmm. the sort of binary. So forest defined by nature, clearings. And so the plan was to create a sort of clearing around the bit where the road would have gone. And so it's memorializing. That comes back to your question maybe about it's surprising maybe there weren't more memorials. I like the idea of making memorial through landscape. So the clearing would have been, it hasn't happened. I mean, maybe it will, because that part of the site is still available, or it's a sort of adjacent to the site. But overall it was a plan, yeah, that you can use trees in cities. You don't have to think that makes it suburban or it makes it somehow not a city. And so that's become a bit of a theme which we're looking at in another project. Yeah, I call it the forest overlay, and it's really a direct counter to the idea of a building overlay. I don't get panicked about buildings. I like buildings. But I think as an urban plan scenario, a forest overlay sounds quite amazing.
It's a fantastic idea, and it's quite sci-fi. Like, it makes me think of those, you know, those beautiful pictures you see about future cityscapes.
Yeah, that's nice.
That actually have a lot more trees in. And I've been one of the things I've been considering when I've been thinking about Hope Peter is the future. And how we can help people actually feel more hopeful about the future. I think to an extent, Corona's given us a little bit of hope back, but there was a sort of deficit of hope, I think, in terms of what was coming. And I wondered, in terms of your work as an architect, and about some of the things I looked into was how cities might be less polluted in the future, the possibility of people growing food in cities inside their own homes or with a little, you know, community gardens, people having their own power sources via solar panels, vertical forests, moss walls, all of that kind of stuff. So things that will probably, no doubt you've come across, and many more things. Do you think that there's hope for the future of cities to be sort of more comfortable for people, better, less polluted, and that there's a chance for the natural world and for cities to go to coexist in the future in a better way?
Yeah, there is a chance. I mean, hope's a funny word too, in a way, isn't it? It's sort of, that can feel desperate too.
Well, I suppose, just to be clear, when I talk about it, I'm talking about active hope, so not wishful thinking, not sort of passive wishful thinking. I think it's the first stop and then you're taking action, yeah.
Yeah, no, I suppose the only reason I say it is because I feel, yes, there's lots of opportunity. It could be way better. And I think probably the good thing that will have come out of this terrible situation is the sort of shock of quiet and the shock of calm, the shock of birdsong, the shock of, is again, it sounds sort of cliche, but I think it's very powerful. The shock of hearing the wind on, you know, and of not going on a plane, not thinking you're going to go into your car. I mean, and the shock to see that the world does go on, the world that is beyond humans is totally fine. I mean, it's obviously happier in many ways, but it's very, nature beyond humans is very, very matter of fact. It's not sort of romantic. It's just sort of getting along, getting on with it. And I think that might be quite important for us to remember, it isn't all about human.
I suppose I feel that people have been encouraged by seeing nature reviving, like you said, the goats in the Welsh towns and sheep in playgrounds and hearing birds and stuff is encouraging. And I feel that there's a chance then that people might consider that and what that means and how we need to better take care of things. And outside sort of seeing goats in Welsh villages and hearing the birds, are there other things about the current situation, Peter, that you feel have actually, although there's been lots of loss and anxiety, do you feel that there are things that we've gained from this period as well as human beings, you know, for you personally and in terms of professionally as well? And if there are any of the changes that have happened as a result of COVID that you would like to perhaps experiment with keeping hold of when it's over?
Well, I think this thing of time is quite interesting, that we all, you know, rock it around. We have, of course, I feel like cities are associated with rush in a way, aren't they, of acceleration. And this is probably the first time in the history of cities that it's decelerated. I would imagine that it's gone faster and faster, and the idea is to operate with greater intensity or greater efficiency, greater turnaround. And I think maybe this has sort of challenged that. And so also that you have to find patience and calm within yourself somewhat. And I think probably, you know, all humans have the potential for that, you know, this sort of more meditative existence. And I think it would be awful if we sort of forgot that everybody has sensed this extraordinary moment that it kind of stopped. And there was a benefit to that. I have a feeling it will be very difficult to forget that.
Yeah,
and I suppose that's a big worry for me, actually, that a lot of people might find it very, very hard going back into that sort of rather hard existence, particularly in cities where you spend so much time and money to exist with not, you know, in the end, it's for quite a questionable return. So I think it might be harder now to go back into that, having had a taste of, you know, another way cities could exist. So I think our duty is not forget and also implement adjustments, isn't it?
I think so, yeah. I think there is the opportunity and the chance for change to happen right now. And in sort of relation to that, and again, in response to the last thing you said, do you, if you could sort of implement a kind of a new normal, if you like, after this, so if we don't go back to what we had, how would you like, talking specifically about your work and about cities, what would you like to keep for cities? Is it just this sort of general, perhaps maybe looking at the possibility of things being slower paced?
Well, I think it does come back to forests again. I think we need to set aside a lot more space for vegetation and habitats in a kind of, you know, serious way. It's not, I mean, of course, bit by bit makes a difference, but I feel much more radically than just sort of avenues of trees. I'm talking about sort of forest in raw forms, and it's not all pretty. Nature's not all pretty, and I think we probably do have to learn that the stuff that seems has grown to seem not applicable to human life probably is. So that gets back to the thing of sort of organisms and soil and dirt in a way that is not unhealthy. It probably turned out to be very healthy. I think there's a way to be much more radical. I mean, I always have this idea that I have a picture of Oxford Street. If you sort of took out, not just sort of took out the rubber, you took out the pavement and you didn't have any hard surface and it was trees and understory and soft, and you had to sort of like wipe off your feet as you went into the shops on a little kind of cattle grid, and maybe you wore bare feet. I mean, that's what I feel like I want to interrogate, because, and then there would be, you know, insects and things around that we say, oh, we don't want that. But I think I think we probably need that.
Yeah, it's part of it, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's probably, in ways we might never quite understand, it's really essential. So I was just mentioning the idea of, apparently the perfect hospital has, you know, every corner covered, no crack, all sterile. And that's where the superbugs arrive from. And I think you can't do it. Humans have got to learn that they can't sort of beat nature, I think. And it's sort of surprising to me that we're still taking this long to see that. And in fact, I think I always say this thing about those hospital floors that were all wood. You know, I have a feeling that was quite important, that there's a sort of antiseptic and a breathing. I don't think there were any superbugs then. So if you extend that sort of analogy to wider life, then I think leakiness and, the chance to lose control is probably quite key. And I think it takes maybe something as serious as this situation to allow radical changes to happen. So maybe that's hopeful.
That is hopeful. They certainly, I think, invite the conversation. And then the conversation is out there. It started, isn't it?
Yes.
And it's hard.
And it makes it easier to argue radical things, maybe.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it's about being courageous and remembering, like you said. If you, lastly, Peter, thank you so much for your patience with our technological problems.
Sorry about my internet.
No, it's fine. If you kept a little jar, and every time you thought of something that you missed. Rather than the things that you gain. So if you thought of anything that you might have missed during the course of the last few weeks whilst we've been down in lockdown, and you wrote on pieces of paper and kept them in a jar, things that you might have missed in the last few weeks, if anything, what might those things be?
Well, I think it has to be touching people, doesn't it? That you that we now, a lot of people have said this, that you look at a film of people in a group and it sort of seems like, oh, it doesn't feel safe or something. We've got used to this idea of distance from other people. I think that's, you know, I put my arm around people quite a lot. So
yeah.
I think that's definitely a weird one. And I mean, I've been very lucky because I can go into nature, so I've got more of that than I have. But, you know, what you don't have here is cultural, you know, ability, museums and going to, whether it's to look at things or to, I guess, also gatherings. That I know would drive me totally nuts after a while. The idea that you can't go and observe in body cultural output, because again, that's something that sets, I think, the animal world and the human world aside. We're very lucky that we exist in a kind of contrived, if you like, cultural settings, which are, you know, about critical thinking and observation that nature can't offer that in quite the same way, I think. So I definitely miss that.
Yeah, those are things that we will be able to get back to, which is comforting, I think. Or I'm sure, hopefully,
that's
we'll
true.
Be able to
yes.
get back to, which is some yeah. comfort. And lastly, where might people be able to find you if they want to find out more about your current projects? Would that be via your website?
At Spatial Affairs is Instagram and Twitter. And the website is spatialaffairsbureau.com. And I think they'll be able to find me. But yeah, I'm always interested in hearing from people that are, interested in the same things we're talking about. Because there's lots to be done. There's lots of very interesting positions on it all around the world. I've spent a lot of time in the US and it's a fascinating place for some of these same issues that we're talking about there too. But I would like to find more of that in the UK, actually.
And what's that? If somebody's listening and they're like, actually, I'm really interested in the future of cities, I'm interested in architectural development, or even in considering becoming an architect, where would you recommend, what books would you recommend, or where to go, or how to find out more about architectural innovation and...
Well, actually, I mentioned the ROBA, and the ROBA have directed people to before because they have on their whole section for, the sort of award-winning architecture. And I think that is quite useful for people. I've done a certain amount of teaching about architecture in schools, and I've found the most effective way to work is to show students extraordinary things, you know, extraordinary works of architecture, because it all breaks through the mundanity of what they might be used to sitting around that isn't maybe an obvious route to feeling like you could change things. So I think it's quite good to see really ambitious and, rewarded or awarded pieces of architecture. So I'd say ROBA website is a great place. In London, the ROBA bookshop. And also just it's about going to places, isn't it, that are wonderful, create wonder. And that can be train stations or cathedrals or, you know, extraordinary parks. So I think that's another thing to try and get out and find out maybe what in your area has got, they call it ROBA award scheme. So maybe that would be a thing to look on the ROBA website, but look, because it's regional too, you could look at what has won awards in your area and just walk around it and see what you think.
That's a really good idea. And for you, Peter, if you had to choose one building that you might go to revisit to say, this is why I love doing what I do and this building is inspiring to me. If you had to choose one, what might that be?
Interesting. Well, I do like buildings that are kind of are on the border between building and sculpture and environments or shelter. And I think the Pantheon in Rome is really extraordinary for that, because it's so big that it could also be a kind of landscape, and it doesn't actually have it's not sealed, it's open at the top. So it's a kind of ephemeral situation. And, you know, of course, it represents cultures over thousands of years, which I like. So maybe that.
That's amazing. That's a good choice.
It's not quite a building in a way, it's sort of more and less.
Yeah, it's like an environment. Or,
yeah. Yes, that's right. Lovely. Yeah, an environment. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. It's been really nice to
that's
talk
all right.
to you.
Great to speak to you. It's really interesting.
So much for listening. Some fantastic ideas there from Peter about ways to engage with buildings and sort of your discover your awe and wonder of buildings. I just wanted to give a shout out with regard to trees. Probably quite a lot of trees feeling quite thirsty at the moment, and there's a great guide as to how to look after and care for trees, particularly street trees, on this website, which is www.treesforcities.org. And also wanted to give a big thank you to Street Trees, who actually do plant a lot of trees in existing tree pits throughout London and in other cities. And yeah, so get involved. I love the idea of living in a city which is also a forest with a forest overlay. It's very Grimm's fairy tales. Thank you so much for listening again, and I look forward to joining you next week. Bye bye.